Hello and welcome to the next edition of the Odd Job Pod. It's been probably longer than a rights negotiation between James Bond's various franchisees, but we are finally there. We are back. Bond is back. The Odd Job Pod is back. I am your host, Gary Andrews, and joining me as ever is Graham Sibley and Terry DeFellin. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello, Gary.
Hello. So, yes, as I say, we've been away for a bit, probably nearly as long as MGM took to resolve various rights issues with assorted characters, but we're there.
Yes, yeah, I think so. Yeah, you are the McClory of the whole thing, aren't you, Terry?
Yeah, I have had to change my name ever so slightly. I've had to add an extra F into my surname just to get around certain legal issues, but, I mean, no one will ever know.
No one will spot that.
No, I mean, really, I should be just pronouncing it as Terry DeFellin. All the way through, just to get through this
with the silent P.
Yeah. Well, I've never used a lie. I never even told anyone about this. How do you know about the silent P? I only have that for tax reasons.
As ever, it's a pleasure. It's good to be back. And we're going to continue where we left off last time, which was a very long cliffhanger, which is coming back to the next set of James Bond villains now in previous podcasts. If you haven't listened to them, do go back and listen to them. It will probably make much more sense if you have. The previous ones, which is we've been doing really the World Cup of Bond villains and separating that into various groups. So we've had the pseudo Blofelds, we've had the Blofelds, and then we've also had the middle management as well, who were trying to masquerade as villains, but obviously doesn't really work because middle managers, you can only go so far with villainry with them. But this set of villains is what we might call contemporary grit. Now, that's not something that's needed too much in the West Country during cold snaps. It is actually, what we've termed as contemporary grit is the Craig era villains, who we haven't discussed. So removing Blofeld. So that leaves us with Le Chiffre and Silver, because Green essentially was a middle manager. And also the Dalton era villains, who I think it's fair to say, gentlemen, both Sanchez and Koskov have a fair amount of grit to them.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Koskov was an interesting one, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I don't know whether or not I'd necessarily say he was completely gritty, but, I mean, he was duplicitous, wasn't he? Masquerading as a goodie.
Yeah, I think we'll have a lot of late Cold War fun with Koskov.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, if I say he's not terribly gritty, I mean, he did try to get his girlfriend killed.
Yeah, that's quite
gritty. In the pre-credit sequence, which is fairly gritty.
Yes, in itself.
Yeah.
Yes, you know what, let's start with Koskov, because actually The Living Daylights to me is a really we've discussed many a time. It's a fascinating film. It's obviously your reset that you've got after your previous one, which was A View to a Kill, which was quite something in terms of a spectacle. And by that stage, you know, it always gets when you have a new Bond in, they try and reset it. And by that stage, previous Bond has gone a bit excessive and perhaps a little bit on the silly side. And The Living Daylights and Koskov, and you can probably bring Brad Whittaker into it as well, because he was obviously the villain who snuffed it in the end, whereas Koskov didn't, unusually for the grand schemer. Koskov survived. For me, I one of the things I really like about the villainry in The Living Daylights is that it actually feels much more truer to James Bond's spy roots than it is for an action set piece, because there is this cross, there's double cross, there's lots of things going up underneath the surface. And actually, when you look at Koskov, I love him as a character because he's incredibly pleasant, very good at playing dumb, very charismatic, but there's so much ruthlessness that actually his very affable manner gets sometimes just sort of glosses over it a bit. And then when you look at it, for me, I think actually there's a level of just terrifying, because he isn't just out and out scary or kind of there sat there cackling. He's somebody who can very pleasantly just kind of go, yep, dispose of her, you know, when he in the jail sequence where he's in the base where he decides to not take Kara with him and just hands her over to the jailers. I mean, that's sort of an incredibly casual piece of villainry that just is done with a very affable wave of the hand, really.
I think he's an extremely modern villain, and I think you could have his character in a very modern James Bond film and he wouldn't look out of place at all. If you look back through the canon of Bond, you can look at villains that would just seem ridiculous now in a modern day film. But I think really Koskov really is one of the last ones that you can really look back on and think, you know, no, he would still do fine now.
He definitely represents a change in thinking with regards to James Bond villains, I think.
Yeah.
I agree. I think, I mean, one of the things about Koskov is that he is just such a likeable guy. I mean, when he's introduced to us,
yeah,
there's the whole thing about his defection into the West using the pig, the pipeline. And that whole sequence from when he's initially retrieved from the gents' toilets and stuffed into the back of the car, or stuffed into the car, and he's hugging James, and it's all done for comedic value.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great misdirection, actually, because we're so used to formulaic James Bond villains, we can spot one a mile off when we're watching James Bond movies. But at this point, we're strongly, and I think quite cleverly, encouraged to believe that this is one of the good guys.
Yeah.
We're not really experienced that degree of duplicity.
Yeah.
That we think this guy's going to be like perhaps another Kerim Bey or something like that. When in fact, the Kerim Bey of the movie is John Rhys Davies' character.
Yes. Yeah.
Who is, what's the name of that guy? General, I want to say Putin, but it's not, is it?
Pushkin, I think.
Pushkin,
that's close. It, of course, yeah.
So, and indeed, when he's briefing MI6 in that townhouse, in that country house, you know, even that routine is all, he's got his hamper from Fortnum & Mason's, and he's sat there and he gets his shoe out and he's comically waving his shoe around, you know.
Yeah.
And he's sort of like portrayed as being almost a sort of like a bit of a, you know, clumsy, perhaps eccentric.
Oh, yeah.
It works quite well because it turns out he's a complete psychopath.
Yeah.
He's a massive, he's a pathological liar.
Mm.
I think he's completely sincere as a character in his feelings towards James Bond, for example. I mean, I think he genuinely likes him, but has no problem whatsoever with you know, killing him.
So do we think then that Koskov really wrote the narrative for Western observation of what Russians are like for the next 30 odd years?
Openly very friendly.
Openly friendly, a bit bumbling, but
at the same time, I think that I hadn't thought of it like that. I'd have to give that some thought, but I've got a lot of time for that idea. Yeah, we're looking, you're saying that our modern perceptions of the Russians, quotes the Russians, not necessarily specifically Russian people, but the Russians is that, you know, they're good fun to be around, but they will, you know, they'll actually mean you harm.
Well,
and
go
want to dominate you.
Go either side of that film, two films. So go two films before, and you've got Octopussy. Two films afterwards, you've got Goldeneye, and the portrayal of Russian generals in there goes back to sadistic, war crazy.
Yes.
Yeah, to mass murderers, doesn't
it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, really one dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not
all
even
of in the, in
all yeah. of I mean all of is brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a shame that we haven't been able to include us in that pantheon. But I guess we're talking about him now.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the character in Goldeneye.
Yeah, it was Trevelyan's
flunky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was good as well. But yeah, you're right. Extremely one dimensional.
Yeah.
You know. Whereas we were, and also Living Daylights comes out at a time just before the end of the Cold War.
Yeah.
Just before, during Glasnost.
It's in its last knockings, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's a perhaps an understandable softening of the Soviet Union characters, because we're all instinctively preparing ourselves for changing times, you know. And
do you think
plays in really nicely.
I was going to say, Graham, I'll go to you first on this, but do you think a character like Koskov, unusually perhaps for a Bond villain, you could probably put him into the next Bond film, if you will, and his character could be in there, and he would be completely plausible in this day and age, as well as when he was written in the late 80s, which I guess probably can't really be said for too many other Bond villains.
I think you could have a return of Koskov, just coming back, you know, being some oligarch or someone very, very high up in the Kremlin. Either way, you know, it'd certainly be someone who would easily fit into a Bond film and the Bond narrative.
Does Koskov actually survive this ordeal? Because, I mean, was it? It's a Pushkin's last final remarks are, you know, bring, put him on the first plane back to Moscow in a diplomatic bag, which suggests to me that they're going to gonna whack him.
Well, yeah, but you don't see
but
a body.
But we don't see it happen.
So, you know, even when you see a body sometimes...
Yeah, it's not always enough,
yeah. Is it?
No, and then obviously, we you know, if we're talking about the Living Daylights, and we'll stick on it just for a little bit... It, for me, I always find it quite interesting in terms of the villainry. Obviously, there is the implication at the end that that Koskov is offed with. He's Koskoffed. But then you've also got Brad Whitaker, the American. And actually, he's somebody who is much more within that villainry side of things. Although he's quite, again, I would say in terms of Whitaker, he's a very... He's a little bit more one-dimensional, but he's also one of those Americans that's introduced, and there's not too many of them in The Living Daylights, and he's completely immoral. He is not sort of particularly one side or other. He's there for complete profit. And it's interesting when you bring Whitaker into it as well, because he's as much of a product of the 80s as somebody like Koskov for me. I don't know how you feel about that, Terry.
Yeah, no, he is the ultimate opportunistic arms dealer, isn't he? And taking advantage of free markets and the black market, and very much a child of neoliberalism, and it works really, really well. Completely amoral, but also sadistic as well, and obsessed with, because he's obsessed with war and with great generals and not so great generals, butchers as well. And you know that is the denouement of his character as well, isn't he? That's how he meets his Waterloo. But yeah, I mean, I think again a very modern villain, certainly very contemporary. I mean, in that respect, he shares similar characteristics, I think, to Zorin, although very 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 different people, with very different actors, but with that same sort of like embracing of the sort of free trade. You know, I'll sell anyone anything to anyone kind of attitude that I think, although not portrayed in A View to a Kill, I think meets the kind of characteristics that I think Zorin would have had as well, had we done another film about Max Zorin. Who knows? So, yeah, I mean, he is indeed a contemporary villain.
Yeah, of course, the most memorable thing about Brad Whitaker is, in fact, he's played by Joe Don Baker, who actually returns as another character in the film franchise, which is always lovely. Is always lovely when you see a villain come back as a good guy. Obviously, Charles Gray,
exactly.
is the best example of it.
I mean, just before we move off Koskov / Whitaker, I mean, I think. Graham, I don't. For me, when you discuss great Bond villains, probably Koskov doesn't necessarily come to mind, but what we've talked about, actually, I mean, it kind of, to me, feels like he's a very, very good villain, albeit one that perhaps is slightly underappreciated, is probably the wrong word, but certainly when you think of your classic Bond villains, you might think of your Zorins, you might think of your Goldfingers, you know, you probably might think of obviously you think of the Blofelds. Do you think Koskov perhaps is a little bit sort of underrated or underappreciated within the Bond canon, because of perhaps where he sat and the fact that he's not sort of a megalomaniac that sort of is, you know, trying to blow up the whole human race? He's just a very duplicitous, nasty piece of work.
I think it's probably the fact that, unfortunately, the Dalton films are sadly forgotten. And I think, obviously, everything else that appears in them is also sadly forgotten. He doesn't get great lines. There's no real big action scenes, real memorable action scenes with him involved in them. So I think it's very easy to forget a character if they're not on the showreel.
Yeah, he's a great villain, but he doesn't those kind of moments, which really stand out, or he hasn't got those kind of characteristics that make him stand out. Either visually or...
Yeah,
or,
exactly. Or I mean, if he'd had Dalton strapped to a table with a laser about to slice his nads off, then then yeah,
he might well have been induced. The writers might have been induced to write some killer dialogue for him.
Yeah,
but he didn't have any of that killer dialogue that goes through.
No,
he wasn't wearing a Nehru collar. He wasn't bald headed. He didn't have a scar.
No, and he's not got a knotted rope and bashing someone's balls in. A lot of them. Perhaps it's probably more to do with the fact of like James Bond's balls being up for in danger. But maybe that's what the secret of making a memorable villain.
That could just be you.
Yeah, maybe that could be.
We will come back to Bond's manhood in a short while. But whilst we're in there and talking about villains that potentially forgotten, I have to say, actually, when I think of Bond villains, Sanchez is actually one of my favourites. And License to Kill is actually one of up there with some of my favourite Bond films as well. And again, I mean, obviously, as you said, Graham, the Dalton films do tend to be a bit forgotten. But there are... Sanchez is a villain who is exceptionally nasty. I mean, he feeds Felix Leiter to the sharks. He ties Bond up and on a conveyor belt, is about to be dropped to his doom in a chemical processing plant. There's some great set pieces in there, and Roberto Davi for me is he's just a fantastic, brilliant encapsulation of the era villain.
Yeah, certainly, very much. He is that, but I think in many ways he is forgotten because he is so much of the era, and so there are so many other films. Remember, this is right at the start of the VHS sell-through explosion, and so there are so many action films that are coming out with villains like him, often being played by the same guy, in big set piece action extravaganzas. That's why License to Kill is a big set piece action extravaganza, because there are so many other films like that, and Bond is being left behind a bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is it's an attempt by James Bond franchise to ape those great 80s action flick movies.
And, yeah,
I mean, the movie reminds me an awful lot of Lethal Weapon. You know, it's the lighting and the just the production and the Michael Kamen's score as well lends an awful lot to that. I mean, they got the Lethal Weapon guy, said we'll get the Lethal Weapon guy to come over and do our movie and give it that really very, very contemporary feel. And Sanchez reflects that. And I think that that's the sadness of the character of Sanchez, and why perhaps he's not fondly reminded, because although he's a great villain, in many ways he's a villain for another movie and for another movie franchise.
Yeah.
He's a Lethal Weapon franchise villain. He's not a James Bond.
Yeah.
Franchise villain, and I mean, you know, I still love it, and I still love him as a villain. But...
Do you know what it reminds me of? And you'll know this, Gary. I don't know if you will as well, but it's like the episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. that George Lazenby's in.
Oh right, yeah. What you mean, The Return from The Man from U.N.C.L.E.?
Yeah.
You mean JB?
Yeah.
Yes.
When James Bond is parachuted into a Man from U.N.C.L.E. episode, basically.
Just to liven things up.
Yeah, and, it's like James Bond is actually in Lethal Weapon or something like that, isn't it? This film,
I think on reflection, as much as I really love that movie,
yeah,
I mean, it is a clumsy attempt at that little subgenre, and from a production company that isn't used to making those kinds of movies. They moved also to the I think it's Churubusco Studios in Mexico, I think is where it was filmed, which is not Pinewood. You know, and you know, the photography is, it's not quite as well polished a movie as previous James Bond movies, and I think it does suffer a bit.
You don't seem to say that they use non-union.
They may well have used non-union Mexican equivalents. Who knows? But I mean, I think that movie is a movie that is not entirely comfortable in its own skin, because I think it's trying to do something that it's not used to.
There were problems, and you can see why there was such a big gap afterwards as well.
Yes, they had to have a really good rethink about it. But I was heartened to learn that, in fact, Tim Dalton was asked if he wanted to come back, but at this point had said he was done with it.
But then again, if you were involved in a film like that, it may have put you off.
Yeah, you might have thought this is way too much trouble than it's worth, frankly. Yeah. But yes, I mean, he is a great villain, because I mean, he's got this great. I mean, as much for everything we've just said about License to Kill, it does have an absolute killer underground complex.
Oh yeah.
I mean, all right, they're manufacturing heroin, you know, to go out. You know, I mean, he's essentially a drug dealer. But I mean, you know, it's a cracking underground complex.
Yeah. And his henchman's brilliant.
His henchman is wicked. Benicio del Toro is amazing. I mean, yeah. He's an amazing actor, and he looks great in this movie because he's brilliant. A young Benicio del Toro. He's lithe, he's energetic, and he's just like, he's got those dead
full
eyes.
Full of evil,
and he's just full of evil.
And of course, though, with Roberto Davi, there is always a little bit that you can't escape from him, which is the Goonies.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head then, right? Yeah, well done. Well, I think no more needs to be said about that.
Yeah, I think when the Goonies is referenced, it's time to move on to another subject.
Ah, yes, the Goonie rule.
The Goonie rule. We all know the Goonie rule, guys.
So many people fallen afoul of it. I think we can say that. I think by and large, just as we kind of move from the contemporary grit of the... I think we can probably say, though, that the Dalton villains were pretty good.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, they
by and large.
Yeah, I mean, they really fit the time. They're really contemporary, which is good. And if you like the 80s like us, then you know they're nice hark backs, aren't they? Really?
Absolutely. Yeah, I know. Yeah. It would be interesting to see what millennial Bond fans think of those two villains.
Yeah,
it's possible that some of them might not appreciate them in the way that we do. But it, you know, in time, I think it's funny, cause your palette changes over time.
Yeah.
And Bond movies that you didn't have that much time for in the past, you now do develop an appreciation for. And it might well be that will be the case with these guys, and hopefully they'll be revisited at some point in the future.
Yeah.
I would love to see Koskov come back. Actually, that idea that we just to go. Sorry, just to summarising things. I would love to see Koskov come back. I think that would be a really interesting move.
Yeah, I think as we look through the whole of the Bond canon and we see things that are very contemporary within them. Look at Live and Let Die. It can be jarring, but it is so contemporary of the time, isn't it? So it does fit very, very well. And I think these films, in a very different way, do that as well.
Yes, I entirely agree. Yeah.
Well, so we talk about, well, I mean, you can't really sort of get much more contemporary than Craig. And, you know, obviously, when Bond came back after the, shall we say, the excess and horrors of the end of the Brosnan era with with Die Another Day and the entirely forgettable and quite dreadful, in my opinion, Gustav Graves. You then move through to about as far away as you can get from it, which is Le Chiffre. Obviously, Casino Royale, known and beloved by many Bond fans, and a film that I think obviously they were waiting for that wasn't the 1960s comedy caper, James Bond, but actually one which kind of took it back to its roots, which I think it did well. And obviously at the centre of that, you have the financer of Le Chiffre. And I mean, Terry, there's kind of some actors who you kind of feel would be born to play a Bond villain, and if they didn't ever land up as being a Bond villain, you'd kind of think it was maybe potentially a bit like Brian Clough and the England job, that, you know, how on earth did this never happen? And Mads Mikkelsen is really one of those actors that if he hadn't played the Bond villain, you'd have almost felt that somebody would have had to write a role for him where he could have become a Bond villain.
Okay, just quickly, as an aside, plan for a future podcast when we've done these villain ones, in the same way that we did actors that we would like to see James Bond, we have to go through and produce some actors through the 50 odd years that really ought to have played Bond villains, because I think that's a great topic for a podcast.
Let's write that down. Yeah.
So that's homework for future podcasts. You're absolutely right, Gary. Mads Mikkelsen was almost born to be a James Bond, and it landed. It was perfect casting, wasn't it? Because I mean, he was. And my impression of Le Chiffre from the books is that he played maybe a somewhat older character. I have got a feeling he was quite a corpulent chap.
Yes.
He lived well, whereas Le Chiffre in the movies was not. He was a younger, contemporary of really Bond in terms of age. And a really desperately cold man. And you would be, because if you are a financier to terrorists and to violent and nasty people, then you're going to be a deeply cold and uncaring, frankly, mentally ill individual.
Yeah.
And I think the scene that, of the many great scenes that stick out, it's actually one early in the movie with the where he's playing poker with his friends.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, taking them to the cleaners. And then when he's finished with them, he just tells them, just get rid of these people. Mm. You know, he doesn't even, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, he lacks all the social niceties and has arrived at his station where he can buy his way into big poker games at civilized casinos, not through any charm or social niceties, but simply because he has the money, the brute force, if you like, to get him there. He's chilling. He's a chilling character.
Oh yeah, well, deeply unsettling. The word I picked out on there, what you said, the first descriptor you used for him was desperate, and that's what he is, and that's the whole premise of the book and the film. Is the fact that he's in a desperate situation,
yeah,
and they think he's going to be an easy mark,
yeah.
MI6 think he's there for the taking, isn't he? Really,
yeah, yeah.
And he's not. He is just so desperate. But he lives in this sort of whole desperate world. It's very rare that you see the villains. You see how dangerous the lives of the villains are.
Yeah.
You always see how dangerous Bond's life is because his life's always in danger. But this way, it's flipped around. You see, Le Chiffre he's got enemies everywhere.
Yes,
and he is this close to being taken apart. And in the end, you know, it is the villains that do him rather than Bond.
And that, I mean, this is the torture scene reaches that climax, doesn't it? Because you've got these dual. The two missions of Bond and Le Chiffre, missions for want of a better term, meeting finally in this room, and where Le Chiffre is at this point where he is resorted to the most savage violence and torture to get what he needs, such as his desperation that even he is showing.
Yeah,
I heard a great anecdote on another podcast, actually, very quickly, about a guy who was in the cinema who watched it at Casino Royale for the umpteenth time when it came out, and there were these two lads a few rows down in them, and they were chatting during the movie and blah, 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 until they got to that scene and they were just like watching it, and like, and he's like, yeah, they knew they were watching a film then, you know. And it's such an extraordinary scene. There's nothing like it in James Bond franchise movie history that I can recall right now.
Yeah.
And it's a perfect way to reintroduce that franchise, and Le Chiffre really heralding this sort of like step change in perhaps in villainry, where you've got them being genuinely savage and brutal and visually brutal, whereas sometimes I think there's a certain veneer of brutality and savagery that can almost become a bit comic booky in certain movies.
Yeah, well, you've got Le Chiffre, and obviously Mads Mikkelsen does a fantastic job. You know, we've all talked about how much we love the character, and you know, we love what Mads Mikkelsen brings to the role, and you know, a very different take on Bond villainry simply because of the writing. But Terry, could you make a little bit of an argument for the fact that Le Chiffre could actually quite easily fit within the middle management Bond villain podcast that we did, because he's got his orders from up on high, and he's not the end of the line when it comes to Bond villains.
No, yes, you can absolutely make that argument. I mean, it is the narrative of the story to place him as the main master villain, and he obviously commands henchmen as well, and he has an organisation of his own of which he is the head. But yes, James Bond is actually used to dealing with the top of the chain. You know, your Blofeld, your Hugo Draxes, your Carl Strongbergs. Sorry, that was a bit Soccer Saturday, that wasn't it? You know, villains like, such as Carl Strongberg.
Is he basically in and around the Bond villain area?
He's in and around.
Well, I think this is the point of him, though, because this is the whole point of Casino Royale, is the fact that the Bond is just coming out as a 00 agent, and Le Chiffre is just coming out as a new, basically, head villain. He's about to branch off on his own, because that's what he's really doing. He's got the organisation behind him, and he's in a bigger organisation. But this is him making his push, isn't it? This is his
rather than keeping his bosses happy, he's out for this for himself, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, he's got it alone, and that's why he's got himself into this pickle.
Yeah.
That's why he's taking a huge risk.
Yeah,
but he's going no risk.
But
no
they
gain.
Both are, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
I mean, look, the Bond goes in there knowing that the lifespan of a 00 agent is very short, so he knows that he's Data Number as well.
And
so they've got this balance there, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly.
And when we talk about, we'll just stick with the Schiffer for a minute before we move on to our final contemporary gritty villain. But with the Schiffer as well, quite often we talk about actors who come into the roles as Bond villains being informed about, you know, the roles they've played beforehand. So, you know, obviously we mentioned Roberto Davi as Sanchez and obviously his role in the Goonies, which brings something into there. But then there's other villains that sort of come in and, you know who they've played on TV, or you know a little bit more about them, and they bring their own kind of a thing to the role. For me, with Le Chiffre and especially Mads Mikkelsen being the role, actually it becomes a lot more interesting when you look back on it, because obviously subsequently to being cast as Le Chiffre, he was cast as Hannibal Lecter in TV, which is where a lot of people might well have come into him, especially if you're sort of the age where perhaps you just were a little bit too young for Casino Royale, but then were old enough a couple of years later to see Hannibal, and then you might well have sort of then gone back and discovered Casino Royale. It's quite interesting having an actor who suddenly, when you watch him in another iconic role, it backfills and fills out a lot more around it.
Yes, certainly does. You look at the role, well, what he brought to the role of Hannibal Lecter, and here is he taking a character that Anthony Hopkins made his own. So you've got to really have some brass balls to actually go in and take that and really convert it into your own thing, do you really? So
yeah.
And he does such a fantastic job of it in a frankly bonkers franchise.
It's crazy. It is an insane. Yeah, it's classic Brian Fuller.
Oh, it's really utterly gorgeous.
It's gorgeous. Doomed to fail in acrimony and huge argument, almost certainly with Brian Fuller being tossed out of the studio.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
he is the Marcelo Bielsa of TV shows. He delivers gold for the first 1.5 seasons, and then he's out on his ass.
Yeah, I mean, these are like solid gold curtains, aren't they? They are gorgeous, but they're entirely practical. They don't work. It doesn't work. But look how gorgeous they are.
Exactly. And that final half of Hannibal is impenetrable. It really is. It's just the third season of Hannibal is impenetrable. It really is.
But imagine if he'd made a Bond film.
Well, I mean, this, I think, is the Danny Boyle thing. Isn't
yes.
it? It's like, we want you to make a Bond film, not what you want a Bond film to be. But, I mean, in fair, I mean, what I would say in mitigation is that perhaps Mikkelsen obviously had an awful lot of screen time with which to flesh out the role in a way that Hopkins did not do.
Yeah.
But I reckon you probably caught maybe the first 5-10 minutes of the first episode of Hannibal, of Mads Mikkelsen's performance as Hannibal in the pilot episode, and you know you knew you were watching a heavyweight character here, and he'd had established all the parameters, because everybody goes into Hannibal knowing who Hannibal is. So there's that conceit from the start. Say, we all know this guy's the killer, even though it's not been made apparent to us through the narrative. But we all know because he's a modern day boogeyman.
I'm sure the casting was of him was entirely down to his performance as Le Chiffre as well. They said, "Yeah, we'll have plenty of that, please. Bring that to this role, and we'll be laughing." Yeah. And it worked. And
they stopped short of the crying blood, the blood tears.
Yes.
Which I thought was always a really nice touch.
Yeah.
This is a thing. This is the thing for Bond villains, is that if they've got this odd peculiarity, that kind of, you know, the scar along the face, the third nipple,
the webbed fingers,
or no hand, metal hands, stuff like that. And Le Chiffre is in that respect, he is classic old school Bond villain, because he's got that kind of bodily disfigurement, menacing one. He doesn't have the old bullet going through the masola oblongata or whatever it is, which is the stupidest quirk that I've ever had, sadly. the tragedy of Reynard, the tragedy of Robert Carlyle. Oh God, it's just too much. I can't even know. It makes me weep. Just, makes me weep blood to yes, even think about.
Yes, it does.
But I mean, that is such old school James Bond villainy in what is a very, very contemporary villain in many other respects. Yes.
When we talk about, I think this is a good a segue as any, but you've got, when you talk about sort of actors bringing a lot to the role, you've got the other Bond villain who falls into our contemporary grit category, which is Raoul Silver, played by Javier Bardem. And this is a very different type of kind of actor who brings something to the Bond franchise. Obviously, Mads Mikkelsen was sort of still relatively well known, but not perhaps the kind of full star he is today. Whereas, you know, an actor like Javier Bardem was incredibly well known. This is my own personal view on it, but I know a lot of people have a lot of love for Silver and would regularly put him up there as one of the best Bond villains. But I'm a little bit more indifferent to Silver than perhaps I might be. And this, there might be the variety of reasons for that, partly the writing, but also partly because if you're actually looking for a definitive Javier Bardem villain, you go to No Country for Old Men, not for James Bond.
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. But I mean, No Country for Old Men, I mean, with all the greatest respect and love that we have for the Bond franchise, No Country for Old Men is a cut above in every respect.
Yeah.
It's better than most films you'll ever watch.
Yeah.
It's certainly better than the best James Bond film.
Yeah, and you've got to think when Bardem plays Silver, he's having fun. He's having a whale of a time with Silver, isn't he? And you can see that.
Mm.
Silver is the closest, I think, that Bond gets to having the Joker in a film.
Hmm. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I mean the other, it's because there's that shared bond between the two of them.
Yeah, the flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah, that they are essentially. Yeah, I mean he's one of, I mean he because the thing with him is he's one of M's failures, isn't he?
Yeah,
and presumably there are a number of him dotted around the world who have been mentally and physically scarred by the experience of working in for MI6 and working for M. Yeah. Bond is something of the golden boy, the guy who keeps coming through.
Yeah.
So there is that personal dimension that is introduced, that connection, that relationship, which is explored further in the next movie, of course, with Spectre, unwisely in my opinion, but not in others. And that makes him somewhat different, and it makes their conversations a lot more intimate. And the script writing for the moments they have between each other is deliberately written to be very, very intimate, almost familial, or in some cases, and if not familial, then almost, sort of like deeply intimate, as though they were, as if they used to go out. Maybe they had a torrid relationship at one point. It's almost like that sometimes.
Well, you get the impression that they're both psychopaths, aren't they? That's the problem with them, is the fact that one is, for want of a better word, a tame one.
And this is the subtext of Skyfall that I think a lot of people don't want to acknowledge.
Yeah,
and there's an awful lot of people saying, "Oh, the Home Alone ending," and "Oh, actually, it doesn't make any sense." You put it together, see the actual chain of events that take place during this movie is not what the movie's about. The subtext of the James Bond movie is that it's exposing James Bond for the absolute certifiable nutcase that he is.
Yeah.
And that if he wasn't he wasn't given a license to kill, then he would be, and who knows what carnage he would have unleashed.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most controversial moments, obviously, is the shootout on the island, isn't it?
Yes.
And how horrible it is.
Mm.
And it's meant to be horrible. And the fact of Bond's reaction to it, that's not a mistake. That shows him for what he is.
Mm. No, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and in fairness, then the helicopters arriving all at the same time, and the big rousing Bond theme ending shows, perhaps also a degree of psychopathy on behalf of the producers as well.
yep. Well,
I mean, it's a hideous scene.
Oh, gotcha.
I mean, and it is. It's unsettling, And it, I mean, I know people who will have said, that is it, I am done with James Bond. That is a level of misogyny that I am not prepared to accept anymore. And I do not blame them at all for taking that view.
It, interestingly, though, just to come back to what you said, Graham, in terms of, you know, silver being one of the closest things that the Bond franchise has to the Joker. Obviously, we are in an era and you know, Skyfall came out in an era where superhero films, comic book films, were very much in vogue and sort of have been for quite some time now. And Heath Ledger's Dark Knight was, I think, 4 years earlier than Skyfall. But we talk a lot about, in previous podcasts, about Bond being, you know, a product for Sierra and aping what's around there. How much do you think that potentially informed it? The fact that you've got what was the very popular films of Chris Nolan's Batman films at that point in time, where you had a very dark, incredibly flawed superhero. How much do you reckon that sort of came in to sort of that balance off between Silver and Bond within Skyfall?
Hugely, and I think it's no coincidence that Christopher Nolan's been talked about a lot as being a Bond director because of the synergy there is between Skyfall and his Batman films. It's what Bond's done all the time, isn't it, really?
Yeah, do you think so? I mean, I think that the really early days of those villains, they didn't have the vulnerabilities. They tended to be quite perfect. They were in complete control of their situation, whereas the kind of Bond villains that we've been talking about, there's a vulnerability to them. Or there's a side to them that we can relate to and identify.
Yeah.
And they've become incredibly important part of the Bond franchise, the villains. I mean, you know, really, they are essentially co-stars.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess they always were, but I think you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think also helps if you want to get a top-level actor to come in. They're not going to come in for a one-dimensional role.
I'm not going to sit in a chair stroking a pussycat.
No.
You're going to need me to do something, give me a character that you want to get into. And actors they aspire to play James Bond villains. And so the production companies, the writers, the director has to respond to that challenge.
Yeah.
If you've got these great actors, you know, really queuing up to play James Bond, you know, then, you know, you've got to give them something to go on. And that's one of the examples of how the franchise has changed throughout the years.
Yeah.
I mean, they've always got great actors to come in and play these villains, but you know, there's so much more demands on them. And contemporary audiences, at the same time, they want to be able to relate to their villains. They're not satisfied that a villain is just simply evil. They want to know why.
Yeah.
They want to know. They want some way of being able to even sympathise to a certain degree.
And that's
the glory of Heath Ledger's Joker.
His times have changed. So you can't just put a Chinese bloke in there. Oh, well, he's obviously a villain then, isn't he?
No. You can't.
Yeah.
No, you totally can't. And in fairness, because modern audiences wouldn't see it like that anyway.
No.
It's only us who brought up in the racist 1970s might come to that conclusion. But, I mean, you know, happily, modern audiences have moved on, or most of them anyway. I think that this is ultimately, we understand this is how Danny Boyle lost his gig, because there was a disagreement over the villain.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have no idea what it was all about, and I don't know who was right or who was wrong. It's not important. But what is important is that this was a big deal. Who is going to play the villain? What kind of role is the villain going to be? And if you're having a disagreement over that, then you don't have a Bond film.
No.
I think it's interesting when you talk about that as well. When you look at the last two villains that we've talked about in terms of Silver and in terms of Le Chiffre, played by Mads Mikkelsen and Javier Bardem. Both actors really sort of come from a European art house scene, as opposed to, say, somebody like, you know, Christopher Walken, for example, and certainly compared to somebody like Roberto Davi, who played Sanchez. And even when you look at most of the Brosnan-era villains, sort of none of them really could be accused of coming from that era. And you know, to a lesser extent as well, you've got somebody like Christoph Waltz. You know, these are European serious actors who've basically earned their chops through serious films. They are not there just because as soon as you see them crop up, as soon as their name's linked, you know they're going to be a wrong one. You always know that there's, you know, yes, they got that villainry in their locker, but equally as well, there is an element of, this is a serious actor doing what is essentially, you know, James Bond films are never entirely serious, let's be fair, but you've got a very serious actor in Mikkelsen and certainly in Bardem, who's a, you know, multi-award winning actor who's starred in Academy Award winning films and who starred in incredibly sort of, you know, art house European fare, which is where he sort of started out. It's a very different route to a type of Bond villain than it is from perhaps some of the, certainly for the more era of villains, potentially, but sort of other ones as well that crop around there.
Well, let's chuck some more names for you out there. It's interesting that you say that, but let's chuck some more names out there for you. Let's chuck out Adolfo Celli, Gert Frobe.
Mm.
Yeah.
Michael Lonsdale. That's very Lonsdale.
True. Michael Lonsdale, yeah, that was the one I was
Kirk
thinking
Jurgens.
Of. Yeah.
European actors.
Yeah.
You know, who had a European profile, but not necessarily
a global one.
Kurt Jurgens turned up in... Turns out, I think he probably made a career of turning up in some Hollywood movies playing the sort of the Nazi general. But I mean, certainly not beyond that range. But all of these guys had massive profiles in European cinema.
And I guess you could say Stephen Berkoff as well, actually, came from that sort of background as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it doesn't necessarily... So there is a fine tradition in James Bond franchise in recruiting, and not just the Bond villains, but Bond girls from European cinema, where they're actually extremely well, and it's a very smart move, of course, because it plays well into the European markets.
Yeah, it's probably one of the many reasons for its longevity and its success.
Yes. It goes
globally when it wants to bring actors in,
and they're great actors.
Yeah,
and they're cheap.
Yes,
because they're making an English language movie, so they're going to be
For Eon is very, very important.
This stuff matters
because they like making money and they like keeping it.
they like making money and they don't like writing checks.
It's funny saying.
So far, we've called them stingy and psychopaths. I might need to edit this this podcast.
I'm sure they have excellent lawyers as well.
They are also, heavily legal. They're beautiful people, and we love them.
Yes, we certainly. It's actually quite interesting what you say in terms of European actors as well. That one thing that I do actually happen to know is that Eva Green in Casino Royale was actually cast, I think, only about a week or two before they started filming. They were really, really struggling to find her character, and Eva Green was actually very late to the party in there. She was cast very, very late in the day.
That would not surprise me at all. I mean, I think if I'm not a casting director, but if I was casting Vesper, you have to get that spot on, don't you? There is no other character. I think it's harder to cast Vesper than it would be to cast Tracy.
I hadn't thought about that. I shall have to think about that before offering an opinion, so I shall just agree with you, I think.
Okay, well, but that might be a whole pod in its own way.
There's so much.
Vesper versus Tracy,
yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
We're getting many, many good ideas for pods on
here. We are indeed,
We're just full of ideas. We are. We're so creative.
You just have to remember them, that's all. Write them down.
If only we were recording them.
If only. Yeah. If only. You forgot to press record, you idiot.
No!
So if we are let's bring the grit to a roundabout end. If you were going to be ranking the four Bond villains from best to worst in this group of grit, Terry, how would you rank 1 to 4?
Oh, Le Chiffre, Silva, Koskov, and Sanchez.
Wow, Sanchez last.
Yeah, but because Sanchez is great, but he's not a James Bond villain.
Yeah,
he's a great villain, but he's not quite up to that's really wrong. It's not the case at all. He doesn't fit for me a profile of a James Bond villain enough.
Do you know,
they should have given him a thing. They should have given him a thing. That lizard just wasn't enough. He needed a thing.
Lizard certainly wasn't enough.
No.
Yeah, I think I think before this conversation, I might have got this the different way around, but I think I'm inclined to agree with you there. Uninteresting as that may sound, but I think you're right. I think Le Chiffre really is the standout one out of them.
No, he's definitely.
Silver is great, but slightly flawed. And Koskov is actually Koskov needs revisiting because he's a great villain.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to see him.
They're all good.
As an oligarch, you know.
Yeah.
who's come out of the whole thing with money.
Maybe. He's actually made, I think, because of that, because he's made for now. And I think that's what really...
The next thing's going to involve some kind of Russian renegade oligarch who's on the run from Putin's Russia.
Do you think they'll do it in the 60s and stay away from the whole Russia thing?
Altogether?
I don't think Eon will do that. There's far too much money there.
Yeah, that's a point. Or do you think they'll go back to the old days of making up country names like they did on Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Mission Impossible? Making up East European country names because they didn't want to upset the Soviet Union or, you know.
Anyway, it's your turn to rank.
Well, I was going to say, actually, when you look at the four villains, it is actually a bit of a group of death, literally. But when you actually look at them, they're ones who they wouldn't necessarily all sort of top a group if you put them in with other ones, but they certainly, you wouldn't want to put any of them last in a group. So there's certainly a good range of villainry. And I would, as would you, put the Shifra top because it's just a fantastic performance. And I would probably be tempted to put Koskov second, personally, because I like the fact that he just switches from a bumbling character to one who actually, there's a lot of depth and there's a lot of nuance to him, which Silver has as well, but it's not. I don't know. Skyfall is a film I enjoy, but it's actually a film that there's other ones now that I would probably watch ahead of Skyfall. If I'm watching it, I enjoy it a lot, but it's probably actually not one that I would probably reach for the collection. And I guess there's just kind of many bits and pieces in there. And I think Silver is a brilliantly portrayed villain, but I'd actually prefer Koskov just because I think there's a little bit more interest to be had in there. And then, and again, unfortunately, Sanchez last. And I say unfortunately because I genuinely like the character and I really like the film. I License to Kill is one of those ones that whilst, you know, if this would have been recorded just after Skyfall had come out or even about two or three, you know, a couple of years after Skyfall had come out, I'd be, yeah, absolutely, I'm watching Skyfall. Now, if you put Skyfall or License to Kill in front of me, probably depends what mood I'm in, and I might well be leaning towards License to Kill quite regularly.
Really? Skyfall and License to Kill? And so, yeah, okay.
I think Skyfall is a better film.
And then next to it, you've got Skyfall, and then you've got your finger, and your finger goes to License to Kill. Graham, where would your finger go? It has to go on one or the other, all right? I mean, I know where it actually goes, but in this scenario... In this scenario, would it go to Skyfall or License to Kill?
If it was today, right now, I'd probably go to License to Kill just because I haven't seen it in about 5 years. I mean, I've obviously not been watching ITV4 enough because it's always on there.
Man alive, that really is a James Bond.
I bet if I went and turned that on now,
Moonraker would be just starting.
They were waiting for me to turn it on, weren't they?
They've got got the Sibley button. Yeah. But it's basically activate. He's turned it on. He's turned it on.
quick. Well, Moonraker again. Yes, he loves it. Put it on. He loves it.
It's like back in the 80s when they used to put Tour of Duty on whenever I got back from the pub.
How did they know?
How did you
guys know I'd got in from the pub? But also, they'd never show a whole episode because they knew we'd be passed out.
You'll be asleep in 5 minutes.
The 90s.
There is also a bit of a reason why I'd probably lean towards License to Kill, and that's because the Australian free-to-air has a habit of it seems to be almost exclusively showing action films from the 90s. So in the last couple of weeks, I've been watching, I had Total Recall and then followed by True Lies, which I'd forgotten just how good a film and how much I enjoy True Lies, which is probably where I was like, oh, I've watched True Lies. You know what? License to Kill would be a great follow-on to this.
Lies. One of the great game changers of the James Bond franchise, True Lies. Really, really big film for the game for the James Bond franchise.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. And that seems a good enough place to leave it, as we've moved through the grit and we've ended up at Arnie. as we do with most other things. But
and that's the Arnie rule, which means we now have to end the podcast.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, exactly. The klaxon's been sounded. Somebody at ITV4 knows that Sibley's coming home from the pub and is gearing up. He's gearing up the schedule specifically for him. So there we go. There is your contemporary grit villainry podcast. Just remains for me to say thank you very much to Terry DeFellin and Graham Sibley.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
And thank you very much, dear listeners. And we'll be back with the next bit of villainry that we've not yet covered in the next Odd Job pod. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.